It is very good to see all of you here this evening. We're getting on into the book of Numbers. The book of Numbers is a book that has special significance for the church. That would strike a lot of people as sort of surprising, because if there's a title that most people would find uninteresting, it would be the title Numbers, you know, because most folks, that reminds them of arithmetic, and apart from Wally Smith, I don't know a whole lot of people that's just really get excited when they hear numbers. Well, the book of Numbers has some numbers in it, but it has many other things. It covers a span of most of the 40 years in the wilderness. It is really the story of the wandering of Israel in the wilderness. And the reason it has so much special significance for the church is because it is the story of Israel between the time they entered a covenant with God and the time they inherited the promised land. In other words, that's the story of the Christian life. You and I entered a covenant with God at baptism, and at the resurrection we will inherit the promises. And in between is where we find ourselves right now. So there is a very important correlation, because Paul, and we've gone through this recently in sermons, but the Apostle Paul in 1 Corinthians chapter 10 makes a special point of emphasizing that the things that happened to Israel in the wilderness were recorded and preserved as examples for us. They're types. They're illustrations. What we find in the book of Numbers are the same kinds of problems that have tended to beset the people of God collectively down through time. There are portions of the Bible that focus in on the problems we may encounter individually and personally in our personal lives. And there are things, you know, we all go through our trials, our difficulties, our adversities, just on a personal level, individually, privately. But there are also things that we go through collectively, things that we go through in a corporate sense. And I mean that in the sense of as a body, as a group. And the book of Numbers tells that story. There's a lot of interesting things here during this period. It is certainly, we find in the book of Numbers the emphasis that the people of God can only move forward so long as they trust in God's promises and lean upon His strength. In other words, the just shall live by faith. And the book of Numbers shows why Israel of old did not inherit the promises at the time they could have. You know, Paul draws example from that in the book of Hebrews and talks about the fact that all that came out of Egypt with Moses did not enter in. Why? Well, they didn't enter in because of unbelief. And in Hebrews chapters 2 and 3 and getting on into chapter 4, the Apostle Paul keeps going back emphasizing that Israel of old did not enter in. They did not enter in because of unbelief. And then he goes on and says that, today, if there's a promise left us of entering into His promises. And he talks about the importance of today, if you'll hear His voice. You see, that is an emphasis. That is something that we all our lives must focus upon. Numbers is the record of Israel's lack of faith. And because of that unbelief, they were unable to fulfill the calling that God had given them when they came out of Egypt. So we want to focus on that as we open here in the book of Numbers. We're going to look a little bit at the story in the book of Numbers, chapter 1. The Eternal spoke unto Moses in the wilderness of Sinai, in the tabernacle of the congregation, on the first day of the second month, in the second year after they had come out of the land of Egypt. So here we are. They had just erected the tabernacle. We saw that at the end of Exodus. Leviticus is primarily instructions to the Levitical priesthood, the story of holiness, as we saw last time. Moses is now told to take the sum of all the congregation of the children of Israel after their families by the house of their fathers with the number of their names, every male by their polls or by their heads from 20 years old and upward. And so we find the leaders of each of the tribes that are mentioned. I would call your attention in verse 7 to Nashon, who was the son of Amminadab, who was the leader or the prince of the tribe of Judah. And as you go on through the story, you find that he had a son by the name of Salmon, who is mentioned later on, and that was the father of Boaz, who is mentioned in the book of Ruth. So we're looking at Boaz's grandfather here, and therefore the ancestor of King David, but he was, this was the line, let's say the leadership line. There was a prince or chief of each of the tribes. One of the things we do find as we go through the book of, not only the book of Numbers, but any of the this section of Scripture, we find that God is a God of organization. Can you imagine having what must have been at least 2 to 3 million people out there, and they just sort of wander around in this big mob scene? You know, it's taken them a lot longer than 40 years to have gotten across the desert. One of the things we're going to see as we go on, it's very interesting, God had them organized in a precise way. And that, I think, is an important concept, that God is a God of order. And we find that there is structure in His entire kingdom. When you go to the book of Revelation, when you look at any areas that describe the heavenly realm, we find patterns. It's interesting, you know, because there are patterns that follow through, and we're going to see some right here in the book of Numbers in terms of the way things are organized. But I just call one to your mind. You know, you go to the book of Revelation and you read that sitting around God's throne are the 24 elders. You realize later when David organized the priests, he organized them into 24 courses, and there were 24 priests who were the chief of the houses of their fathers. They were organized into 24 groups, 24 courses of the priests, accompanied by 24 courses of Levites. You know, in the 24 elders, we're not given all the details, but undoubtedly there are perhaps, you know, there is a structure. There are 24 courses, if you want to use that term, of in the angelic realm. There are 24 elders, 24 angelic beings that occupy a very high position around the throne of God, and you read of that. There is a structure, there is a parallel. In fact, what we will find as we look at the book of Numbers in terms of what God built in to the nation, we will find that it is a pattern of what we read in the book of Revelation with the structure of God's government for eternity. Come on down. I'll show you that. Goes through here the organization of it, and then they assembled and they took the count, and we have the numbers of the tribes. Judah was the largest of the tribes, almost 75,000 men, 74,600. Of the men, that's in verse 27. We come on through in chapter 1 and it gives all of the all of this number. The Levites, verse 47, weren't numbered among them. They were to be organized differently. Now, we're told, verse 51, when the tabernacle sets forward, the Levite shall take it down. When the tabernacle is to be pitched, the Levite shall set it up. The stranger that comes near shall be put to death. The children of Israel shall pitch their tents, every man by his own camp, every man by his own standard throughout their hosts. The Levite shall pitch around about the tabernacle of testimony, that there be no wrath upon the congregation of the children of Israel. The Levite shall keep the charge of the tabernacle of testimony. Now, you see, the whole nation had the opportunity to become a nation of priests when the covenant at Sinai was proposed. But if you remember the story, they didn't even last 6 weeks. They made the golden calf, and in the aftermath of that, the Levites were set aside. And as we're going to see here, the Levites took the place of the firstborn. Now, this was the Levitical priesthood. The Levites actually took the place of the firstborn. And we will see that here in just a matter of moments, that is the setup as we come on down here in chapter four, where we go through the Levites. What we find here in chapter 2, see, God had the tabernacle set. The Levites camped around the tabernacle. Now, he said they were to pitch their camp, they were to pitch their tents by their own camp, by their own standard. You know, we had a whole lot fewer people to organize. For a number of years, I was the camp captain in Big Sandy for the Feast of Tabernacles, and we had upwards 5,000-6,000 people camped on the grounds. We had more than that, sometimes 10,000 attending the feast, but we had upwards of 6,000 camped in the Piney Woods. Now, can you imagine if everybody just sort of showed up and pitched a tent wherever he felt the urge to pitch a tent? You had thousands of tents out there. And campers and everything else. Well, you can't do that. You can have, God's the God of order. So before people ever showed up, we had a lot number assigned to them. They knew we had the campground laid out with streets and lot numbers, and we first organized it by church areas. I would go up there ahead of time, months ahead, would get the registration list, would go through, would organize the thing out by church areas. We had captains of 1,000, captains of 100, captains of 50, captains of 10. We just used the pattern. You know, it was real didn't have to invent a new system. Just look at the one God gave and say, well, you know, that was, if it was good enough for the camp of Israel. So you had a structure to where we had a city of 5,000 or 6,000 people that literally occurred overnight. And yet we were organized. We had a structure to take care of everything from sanitation and cleaning the bathhouses and trash disposal and somebody to help out on different things. Well, God instructed them here. The tabernacle was in the midst. The Levites were right around it. The children of Israel were camped in a square around. There were three tribes on the north, three on the east, three on the south, three on the west. And on each side there was a flag that was flying that represented that side. The north side, the west side, east side. See, and it's spelled out. Verse 3, on the east side, toward the rising of the sun, shall they of the standard of the camp of Judah pitch. The standard was the flag. So the flag of Judah was raised, and then Nashon, the son of Amminadab, he was the captain over that section. And the ones that pitched next to them were Issachar, verse 5, and Zebulun. They were all on the east. And then on the south side, moving right around, verse 10, the standard of the camp of Reuben, according to their armies. And their flag was flying. And then verse 12, Simeon, and verse 14, Gad were there with them on the south side, three tribes on the south. Then on the west side, verse 18, the standard of the camp of Ephraim. And then we find in verse 20 that Manasseh and verse 22, Benjamin, were camped there on the west side with him. And then verse 25, the standard of the camp of Dan will be on the north side. So their flag was flying on the north. And Asher, verse 27, and Naphtali, verse 29, were there on the north side. Now, let's stop for a second. Let's look at two things. The history and tradition preserves the flags of the four tribes. Judah's flag was a lion, and that's the symbolism that's used for Judah. Reuben was a man. Ephraim was a bull or an ox. Dan was an eagle. Now, that's interesting. If you go to the book of Ezekiel, and if you go to the... Where did they come up with those? Why was it organized that way? Why those four? Well, let me just tell you a sort of an interesting little coincidence. If you go to Ezekiel 1, or if you go back to the book of Revelation in the first few chapters, and you read that there are creatures, there are four creatures around God's throne that have four faces. That's, you know, strikes us sort of odd to have four faces, but they have four faces. They have the face of a man, the face of a lion, the face of an ox, the face of an eagle. In fact, if you read the way they're described, it goes around in the same pattern. So, then when you go back to the end of the book of Revelation, you read about the heavenly city comes down, the New Jerusalem, the city is four square. And guess what? There are three gates on each side. It makes 12 gates. And each gate has the name of one of the tribes of Israel. And of course, what's in the midst? Well, God and the Lamb are in the midst of the city. That's what we're told. What was in the midst here of the encampment? The tabernacle, which had the Holy of Holies, which was the symbolic of the very presence of God, overshadowed by a cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. God placed His presence there. God was in the midst, and He was surrounded in that same way. There's a pattern. See, God sets a pattern, and here we have a structure of the way God organized ancient Israel. And there was a march order. When the time came, you see, as the trumpet was blown and they went out, and then the first two sections left, and then the Levites came there in the middle with the bearing the ark and all the things connected with the tabernacle, and then the tribes that were there toward the end, and so you had this huge procession. Of course, they weren't marching single file. They obviously were spread out. You'd never get a million people somewhere if they were all lined up, behind one another. They had livestock to transport and all sorts of things. But the point is, there was an organized pattern. There was precision. There was harmony, and that is characteristic of God's way. God's structure is set up as a means of teaching us about God and about the whole pattern that He wants forever. And so it's interesting, you see, this pattern that Israel had. And the children of Israel were told in verse 34, did according to all that the Lord commanded Moses, so they pitched by their standards. They set forward everyone after their families, according to the house of their fathers. So they were organized in a way. That way, it was a structure. It was based on the family, and the family grew large. I think it gives us some insight into the world to come and the structure that's set up. Not that we're all going to be living in tents, or that human beings are going to be living in tents, but you know, things are organized out. We'll see when they come into the Promised Land that ultimately, when it was time to inherit, God had Joshua choose lots to assign the different tribes their inheritance, and then each family within that tribe was assigned. You know, it wasn't like the Oklahoma land rush where they all lined up at the line and took off, and the guy that was the fastest and strongest got the best piece, and the fellow that was sort of slow came dragging up the rear and found out there wasn't anything left. God had a pattern where He assigned things out, and each family was given their portion. Then, obviously, whether they were productive and how hard they worked and whether or not they managed well, and all these things would determine, you know, some would prosper more and others would fall on hard times. But God gave everyone an opportunity. And you find that pattern that is there. And I think it's interesting how God organized Israel. And we see that. So then we find the that what God told told Moses here in chapter 3, that in verse 6, bring the tribe of Levi near, present them before Aaron the priest, that they may minister unto him. They shall keep his charge, and the charge of the whole congregation before the tabernacle of the congregation to do the service of the tabernacle. And so we find this instruction, verse 12, I have taken the Levites from among the children of Israel instead of all the firstborn that open the matrix among the children of Israel. Therefore, the Levites shall be mine. So we find here, you see, the firstborn are mine, verse 13, because God smote the firstborn in the land of Egypt. And the Levites were chosen instead. So they numbered the children of Levi, verse 15, numbered them according to the word of the Lord, and it goes through all of that and comes on down of these particular sons, and it gives all of the details. And we're told that the number of Levites, verse 39, was 22,000. Then God told Moses in verse 40, number the firstborn of the males of the children of Israel from a month old and upward. And so they numbered those, and they found that there were, verse 43, 22,373. So then take the Levites instead of all the firstborn. This is what we're told in verse 45. And then this 273 in excess mentioned in verse 46, they were to be redeemed at the cost of 5 shekels a head, and the money was to be given to Aaron and to his sons. And so this was carried out. Now we find organizing here the Levites in terms of their function by their families spelled out in chapter 4. Where we go through each of the individual groups. What we find is that 30 years of age was the age of full service, chapter 4, verse 3. From 30 years old and upward, even until 50 years old, all that enter into the host to do the work in the tabernacle of the congregation. There was a lot of physical work in terms of in the wilderness of transporting and carrying these various articles of furniture, the whole process of sacrificing, which was, you know, being a butcher. I mean, you were slaughtering animals, you were skinning them, you were separating out the pieces and the portions of it, you were, you know, heaving chunks of meat up on the altar, you were doing various things. There was a lot of physical work that was involved. What we find is that the Levites began, other scriptures show that they functioned in an apprentice capacity beginning at 25, had entered into full service, as it brings out here at age 30, functioned that way up until 50. Now, after age 50, other scriptures show that the Levites functioned also as judges, and as teachers and various things. I think the impression is that after age 50, they were not involved so much in the physical aspect of the things that put an emphasis on physical stamina and strength. And if you ever tried to dress out a young ox, you would realize that you know, you're looking at something that's a pretty physical job. They're heavy. You're talking about you know, taking several men to try to heave something like that around. You're splitting it up. You are separating off the head, and you're skinning it out. You're taking the skin and doing one thing. You're doing all these various things. So you're looking at a lot of hard work just from a physical standpoint. And so anyway, the structure is given here, and it goes through and talks about way in which the ark and all of these things were transported. They were covered with certain coverings. There was an emphasis to show respect for God, because the things of God, the articles of furniture of the tabernacle, the ark in particular, but all of the articles of furniture of the tabernacle, were associated with God, and proper respect was shown to the holiness of God. All of these ceremonies were to impress upon them the fact that this matter of reverence and respect to be shown toward God. And where God has placed His presence, the tabernacle and the things there, the holy place, the holy of holies, they were to be deeply impressed, to not treat cheaply and casually that which pertains to God, matter of reverence. There are various matters as we go through chapter 6, deals with the question of the Nazarites. The Nazarites were individuals, men or women who separated themselves, verse 2 of chapter 6, to vow a vow of a Nazarite, to separate themselves unto the Lord. So it was a special vow of dedication. It could last for various lengths of time. We read in the scriptures of several individuals, three that come to mind right off, who were Nazarites from their mother's womb. Samson was a Nazarite, or he was dedicated to be a Nazarite from his mother's womb. Samuel was a Nazarite from his mother's womb. John the Baptist was a Nazarite from his mother's womb. You read of others who took the vow. In fact, in the book of Acts, you read of individuals, some individuals who had taken this vow, and Paul went with them into the temple. Their vow was at an end, and it spells this out. It was days of separation. Chapter 6, verse 3. They were not to drink wine or strong drink, nor anything that came, you see, from grapes. They're not to eat grapes, not to eat raisins, not to use vinegar from wine, not to use wine or strong drink. Nothing came from the grapes, verse 4, from the kernels to the husk. So they were separated from that. Verse 5, no razor was to come upon their head during the days of their separation. Their hair grew without being cut. And verse 6, they were not to touch a dead body. All the days, verse 8 of the separation, he's holy to the Lord. And then it goes through as to how at the end of this time of separation, he comes to the tabernacle. The Nazarite brought a particular offering. His hair and his beard was shaved, and that was presented as an offering. That's mentioned down in verse 18. And then particular sacrifice. And this is the law of the Nazarite. Now, Jesus Christ was not a Nazarite. John the Baptist was. Christ was called a Nazarene. That has to do with the city of Nazareth where he lived, but it has no connection with the word Nazarite. They're just similar sounding words in English, but this was a particular vow. Generally, people would take it upon themselves for a period of, 60 days, 90 days, 6 months, a year, something of that sort. It was a temporary thing that had to do with being set aside for special service to God. And then it was, it was concluded. Interesting, the closing here. This is chapter 20 or verse 22. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to Aaron and to his sons, saying, on this wise you shall bless the children of Israel." The priests were given a blessing that they were to use. There is not a functioning Levitical priesthood among the Jews today. There has not been since the temple was destroyed. But the priests, there are many among the Jews who are recognized as priests. The word Kohen is the Hebrew word for priest. Everywhere you read Aaron the priest, it's just Aaron HaKohen, Aaron the Kohen. Any Jew whose name is Cohen, and it can be spelled various ways, because remember, they didn't use the vowels, they used the consonants, K-H-N in Hebrew. So C-O-H-E-N or K-U-H-N, you know, a variety of ways, Cohen, Kuhn, Cohen, various ways that it's spelled. But they are recognized as priests. They are recognized as they are a Cohen. They have preserved that that name of setting them aside, because their name in Hebrew, you know, if somebody's name is Samuel Cohen, that just means Samuel the priest. And in an Orthodox synagogue, any Cohen who is present, a male Cohen, if he is present, is called upon. This is one of the two or three things left that they have done since the temple has been destroyed. But if a Kohen is present, then at the conclusion of the service, he comes forward and recites this blessing. He's the only one, only a Kohen can recite that there in the synagogue. This was the blessing by which the priests, Aaron and his sons, all priests descend from Aaron. The Levites included the whole tribe, but all of the priests were descendants of Aaron. So it started out, you see, only Aaron and his sons. So the number of priests were very small. As the generations went by, the number of priests grew in multitude. The Lord bless you and keep you. The Lord make his face to shine upon you and be gracious unto you. The Lord lift up his countenance upon you and give you peace. And they shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them. You know, I think this is an interesting blessing to go back and meditate on, just in terms of its significance and what it means to have God's blessing. We ask God's blessing, and when we ask God's blessing, this is really what we're asking, that God would bless you and keep you, make his face to shine on you, be gracious to you, lift up his countenance, and give you peace. So, in chapter 7, we have the setting up here of the tabernacle, and then the offerings that were given are spelled out. The prince of each tribe came forward with the offerings, and then the Levites were consecrated in chapter 8. Chapter 9 brings up an interesting matter, and this is the second Passover. There were some individuals who were defiled ceremonially and were unable to keep the Passover at the appointed time. They were not, they did not meet the criteria that was given. And so God instructed Moses that if someone were unable because of a journey, they were somewhere and were in transit, that could of course occur, things happen, and or they were defiled and unable to participate, that there was a second Passover. This is the first 11 verses. Verse 11, the 14th day of the second month at evening they shall keep it. And so we follow that principle today in the church, and occasionally there's someone who may, for legitimate reason, be unable to attend the Passover, and so there is a second Passover. The chapter 11 goes through the details of how they went forward. It talks about the trumpets of silver and the way in which they were to blow these. You know, they didn't have telephones. They didn't have all the modern means of communication. How do you communicate, you know, with a large group like this? How do people know when it's time to go forward or when various things happen? Well, they had certain codes in terms of these trumpets that were blown, that were used for the calling of an assembly, and they were to blow an alarm, and the sons of Aaron. Also, verse 10, also in the days of your gladness and in your solemn days, in the beginning of your months, you shall blow with the trumpets over your burnt offerings. You know, there are individuals who have gotten off in wanting to devise their own calendar, decide that the one that the church uses, you know, they'll go out and sort of look at the moon and decide for themselves when the beginning of the moon, the month is. Well, God never told the Israelites, go out and sort of look at it, and when you think it's a new moon, well, you just consider, you know, everybody figure his own holy days out. You know, Leviticus 23, Moses was told, these are the festivals of the eternal, which you shall proclaim in their seasons. So it was the responsibility of Moses, or those who were, in that sense, the successors of Moses, to proclaim those days in their seasons. The Levites were instructed to blow the trumpet. This is the way they announced it. They proclaimed it. There was a... you've got to have order and structure. I guarantee you, if you told everybody, okay, everybody just, you know, sort of figure out the beginning of the month, you know, best you can, I'll guarantee you, you'd have no telling how many different days that would be being celebrated, because somebody would, you know, be sure, well, I didn't see it, you know, it didn't look like a new moon to me, I didn't see anything. Oh, I saw it yesterday. Well, I didn't see it yesterday. I saw it today, and you just, I mean, that's the case. What if it's cloudy? What if it's raining? What if you can't see anything? You know, you ever notice sometimes you've got days at a stretch where you can't see the stars, you can't see the moon. All you can see is clouds. Maybe it's raining. It's a thunderstorm. You know, God's not the author of confusion. He set up a system. He gave through Moses and Aaron and the priesthood, he gave instructions in terms of how these things were to be done, and the priests announced it to everyone month by month, and they had a cycle that was set up. There's just a pattern. As we come on forward in chapter 11, we find the people were complaining. People were complaining. And God heard it, and His anger was kindled. Numbers 11, verse 1. And notice, it consumed them that were in the uttermost part of the camp, end of verse 1. It's sort of interesting. Anytime you get a group together, you know, we use the term today, sometimes we refer to people as being fringers. Well, this is sort of where the concept comes from. You know, the tabernacle was right in the middle. And so there were people who wanted to be close. And there were others that really wanted to be as far away from God, where God was, as they could. They were on the edge. And I don't think it's surprising that where probably the most complaining was going on was people that were in the uttermost edge of the camp. They were over here on the periphery. It sort of wandered off, you see. They were all over there griping and complaining. There was an attitude. That's what God was displeased with, was their attitude. They were, they had this attitude of lust. They were dissatisfied. They fell a-lusting, we're told, verse 4. Verse 5, they began to rewrite history. You know, isn't it amazing how people began to reflect back and they said, you know, we didn't have it so bad down in Egypt. Now, back when they were in Egypt, they thought they had it pretty bad. But they got to thinking back and said, you know, we had a lot more variety in the food. We're sick and tired of this stuff God's been giving us. Now, you know, that needs to teach us that we want to have an attitude of being thankful and appreciative. It's not wrong to go to God and ask in the right attitude and the right spirit for certain things, but we want to appreciate and to value the blessings God gave us. You know, they were hungry and didn't have anything. God gave them manna. A little while went by, and then they decided, well, they were glad to get it when they first got it, but then after a while it wasn't you know, exactly the way they wanted to do it. And God then God well Moses went to God and said, verse 11 of chapter 11, Moses said unto the Lord, wherefore have you afflicted your servant? What have I not found favor in your sight that you lay the burden of all this people upon me? Moses was at his wit's end. He said, I obviously have really done something that has displeased you, God. I'm not sure what it was, but I wouldn't be, you know, you wouldn't lay all this on me if I hadn't really, you know, whatever it is, let me know. I'd like to straighten it out. And Moses was sort of at his wit's end, and God gathered 70, told Moses to gather 70 of the elders of Israel, and he poured out or gave his spirit to them, and they were able, therefore, to give Moses more assistance. Now, in chapter 12, we have the case of Miriam and Aaron trying to stir up problems. They were jealous. You know, human nature has not changed. They were jealous of Moses. They were jealous of his stature among the people. And they felt like, well, who's Moses? He's our little brother. So it's hard to look up to little brother. Miriam said, well, I remember when you were just a little baby and I used to take care of you and I changed your diapers and I watched you when you were out in the little little basket floating on the Nile. And Aaron, of course, was 2 or 3 years older than Moses. And evidently they had just sort of chafed a little bit and decided that they spoke against Moses, chapter 12, verse 1, because of the Ethiopian woman whom he had married, for he had married an Ethiopian woman. And they said, has the Lord indeed spoken only by Moses? Has he not spoken also by us? And the Lord heard it. Now, let me mention a little bit about this. This is the only mention of this Ethiopian woman. We're not told any details. This is an event that had happened in the past, and it was thrown up in Moses' face in front of the congregation. So it was obviously something that everybody recognized as not a good thing. And Miriam and Aaron brought it up in a way to put Moses down in the eyes of the people. It was something that had happened in the past. Josephus, the Jewish historian and priest of the first century, recounts the event as having occurred during the 40 years when Moses was a prince of Egypt. And he gives the story of the siege of Mero, which was an Ethiopian fortress, and Moses. All we know of Moses' career as an Egyptian prince from the Bible is in Acts 7. Stephen says Moses was a man mighty in words and deeds among the Egyptians. But he doesn't elaborate on what those words and deeds are. You don't read of them in Exodus. Josephus describes a number of those words and deeds that Moses accomplished among the Egyptians. And that was evidently the occasion of his having married this Ethiopian woman. When he left Egypt, had left by himself, later was married to a Midianite woman. The Midianites, of course, were descendants of Abraham. This was the daughter of Jethro, and you read about her in the book of Exodus. But Moses, or Aaron and Miriam, have dragged this thing up that happened way in the past, and they spoke against him because of this and began to try to put him down in the eyes of the people. And the Lord spoke suddenly to Moses and Aaron and Miriam and called them into the tabernacle, and God dealt with them very severely. He says, why weren't you, why weren't you afraid to speak against my servant Moses? Verse 8. Why didn't you have more respect? The anger of the Lord was kindled against them. Now the problem, it's God never addresses, as you go on through chapter 12, some wanted to take this out of context and use it for other things. God never addressed the subject of the Ethiopian woman that Moses had married years earlier. He did not say it was a good thing. He didn't defend it. He didn't make any comment about that. That wasn't the issue in God's mind. Miriam and Aaron were looking for something that they could embarrass Moses with in the eyes of the people, sort of put him down. You know, it's sort of an amazing fact of human nature. People think if they can put somebody else down, somehow that raises them up. If they can embarrass someone, it's like, well, that sort of makes me a little better. Well, God saw an attitude, and he dealt with that attitude. There was a lack of respect toward Moses, whom God had chosen. in trying to embarrass and humiliate him in front of the people to sort of put him down. And in reality, you see, God took it personally. Why weren't you afraid to speak against my sermon? I put him there. I'm the one who chose him. Why weren't you afraid to do that? Well, you know, that is an interesting lesson. Now, as we come on down in chapter 13, we find that Moses was told to choose out a leader of each one of the tribes of Israel that were to go into the promised land as spies. He sent them to spy out the land of Canaan, chapter 13, verse 17. And they did, and they went through the land, and they brought back their report, and they said, well, it's a wonderful land. It's just like just like God said, except there are giants in the land. Oh, you know, they brought back fruit, and the cluster of grapes was so heavy it took two of them to carry it. It is a land flowing with milk and honey, but there are obstacles. You know, God calls us to inherit a great blessing. But you know what we find? There are obstacles that lie in our pathway. Now, there's no obstacle that's too big for God to deal with. But that takes faith. And what we find in chapter 13 and 14 is the spies came back, and 10 out of the 12 were lamenting and said, oh, there are giants in the land. It's no good. We better turn around and go home. You know, an attitude of absolute lack of faith. God has brought them out here. They've lost sight of God. Now, we look at that and we think, how ridiculous. Why don't they see all that God did for them? And now they're afraid to go forward because there are giants in the land. Well, you know, all sorts of great things. But we find obstacles coming along, people forgetting what God has done and beginning to lament. So we find, you know, they were ready to elect a new leader, chapter 14, verse 4. Let us make a captain and let's return to Egypt. And Moses and Aaron fell on their face before all the assembly of the congregation of the children of Israel. And you know, Moses and Aaron went before God over and over. And they asked God to intervene. And God fought their battles. So, we find the story here in chapter 14. And we're told, God said in verse 30 of chapter 14, you shall not come into the land where I've sworn to make you dwell, except Caleb and Joshua, your little ones, that you said should be a prey. Them will I bring in, and they shall know the land you've despised. As for you, your carcasses, they shall fall in the wilderness. Your children shall wander in the wilderness 40 years, bear your whoredoms, until their carcasses be wasted in the wilderness. After the number of the days in which you search the land, even 40 days, each day for a year, shall you bear your iniquities 40 years, and you shall know my breach of promise. We find this principle of a day for a year brought out here. We also find it back in the book of Ezekiel, that this pattern. Again, we find this period of time, this 40 days. Well, as we come on down in certain details of the offerings are given here in chapter 15, verse 16, we read about Korah. Now, you know, we got a little ways down the road from the problems with not going into the promised land. Here's Korah, who's Moses' cousin, and he's gotten together with some of his buddies, Dathan and Abiram. Verse 2, they rose up before Moses with certain of the children of Israel, 250 princes of the assembly, famous in the congregation, men of renown. They gathered themselves together against Moses and against Aaron and said unto them, you take too much upon you, seeing all the congregation are holy, every one of them, and the Lord's among them. Wherefore then lift you up yourselves above the congregation? You know, sort of a demagogue approach. They came before Moses, and you know, a big crowd gathered around. They said, why all these people are holy? What makes you think you're something? You're just trying to be a dictator. You set yourself up above everybody else. Well, as you come on through the story, chapter 12, or verse 12, Moses sent to call Dathan and Abiram, and they said, "We won't come up." Well, you talk about a couple of smart alecks. They're not even going to show up. You know, is it a small thing? Verse 13, you brought us out of a land that flowed with milk and honey to kill us in the wilderness, except now you make yourself a prince over us. They said, you have not brought us into a land that flows with milk and honey. You've not given us an inheritance. You're going to... You know, interesting how all of a sudden the facts are twisted. You promised to lead us into a land flowing with milk and honey, and we're out here in the desert. That's true. Now, what they neglected to mention is that they wouldn't go into the land that God had led them to because they were, you know, because of the bad report. But it's amazing. You know, history all of a sudden gets rewritten, and here are people standing there nodding, yeah, you know, Dathan and Abiram got a point there. I hadn't thought of that. You can just see it. Human nature, just here it is. And it's all the way down. So God made it distinct. He taught, upshot of the thing, of course, is that God swallowed up Korah and Dathan and Abiram and everything that pertained to them. And they went down into the pit, verse 33. So as we come on down the story, verse 41, on the morrow, all the congregation of the children of Israel murmured against Moses and against Aaron and said, "You killed God's people. You sure were hard on those poor folks. Poor old Korah, he was a nice guy, and you know, I just can't believe you were just so rough." Well, Moses didn't open the ground up. God did. They left that point out. Well, there was a plague that was sent out, and in fact, 14,700 died in the plague. Verse 49, and we find that God then told Moses to take rod, to have the prince of each tribe present a rod, and they did. And the rod of Aaron, as the prince of Levi, was included, and all 12 rods were laid up there in the tabernacle. And the next day they were gotten out, and we find that Aaron's rod, which was made out of almond wood, had put out little branches and blossomed and, you know, budded out and borne out almonds. It had borne fruit, and it was clearly distinct from all the others. That was ultimately laid up before the ark as a witness, as a record. You know, God chooses whom He will. God chose Aaron and his family. And we find that story given here in chapter 17. Chapter 18, God told Aaron, "You and your sons, your father's house with you," verse 1, "shall bear the iniquity of the sanctuary, and you and your sons shall bear the iniquity of your priesthood." And it goes on down what they were to do. And that they were given that they were given charge of the sanctuary, charge of the altar, verse 5, and the Levites were given there to them to do the service of the tabernacle. And as we come on down here in chapter 18, in verse 21, it brings out, "I have given the children of Levi all the tenth in Israel for an inheritance for their service." And then it comes on down that the Levites, in turn, were to offer the were to take the tithes in verse 26, and they were to offer up a heave offering to the Lord, a tenth part of the tithe. In other words, the Levites received the tithe of all the other tribes, and then they, in turn, presented a tithe. They tithed also. They received a tithe, and then they tithed to the priesthood. And so it was the this principle here that is brought through. This is not the origin of tithing. You can go back to Genesis 14. Abraham tithed to Melchizedek. Jacob knew about tithing. You remember when he was fleeing, he promised God, if you bring me back safely, I'll start tithing. Amazing, you know, Jacob was going to even make a deal with God. People still try to do that sometime. But tithing was an ongoing principle. Here we find that God assigned it to the Levites because they were working for him. They were carrying out his ministry at that time. As we come on down, the water of separation, chapter 19 is the chapter that deals with the red heifer, which was the taken outside the camp, slaughtered and burned to ashes. The ashes were mixed with water for the water of purification. This was the basis of all of the purifying statutes. Chapter 20 tells the story of the death of Miriam. It also tells the matter here of Moses losing his temper and striking the rock, not following God's instructions and being told that he would not be going into the promised land. And we have the death of Aaron. Let's note here in chapter 22, we read, we're introduced to Balaam. Now, the story of Balaam is a very interesting story. We don't have time to go through all of the details of it. I would encourage you to go back and read it. And when you do, you want to tie in a couple of other key sections in the New Testament. In Jude, verse 11, we read about those who ran greedily after the error of Balaam for reward. Back in the book of Revelation, in chapter 2, verse 14, we read about those who hold the doctrine of Balaam, who taught Balak to cast a stumbling block before the children of Israel, to eat things sacrificed to idols, and to commit fornication. That was the doctrine of Balaam. What we find as you go through chapter, beginning here in chapter 22, Balak, who was the king of the Moabites, saw these Israelites, and he knew that it was going to take more than what he had to get rid of. So they sent to Balaam, who was, if you look on a map, Balaam lived a long distance away. He lived up on the northern Euphrates River, Pethor. He was obviously the chief pagan priest of the ancient world, and they needed a heavy-duty fellow down there. So they sent presents. Balak loaded up he sent some emissaries up there with presents for Balaam. Balaam wanted to come. We're told that Balaam loved the wages of unrighteousness. See, Balaam wanted to come. God told Balaam not to. So Balaam very sadly turned him down and told him no, God wouldn't let him put a curse on Israel. So Balak decided, knowing Balaam, Balak decided they must not have offered him enough money. So he loaded up some more prestigious individuals, sent them back up there with a bigger offering, bigger money. Boy, Balaam's eyes lit up. He really wanted to go. And he knew that God didn't want him to go. God finally told him, he said, well, you can do what you want to. Boy, you can just see old Balaam's face lighten up. You know, God lets people do that. Today, God makes plain what He wants us to do, and then sometimes, you know, people keep, well, you know, I sure like to do that. And God says, well, you can do what you want to. Well, Balaam started out the next day, and he got a little ways down the road. You remember one of the funniest stories in the Bible? Balaam is here on his donkey on the way down the road. All of a sudden, the donkey stops. In fact, he has trouble with the donkey. The donkey, in one case, goes out in the field. In another case, he jams up against a rock wall and hurts Balaam's foot, and finally just stopped and won't go any further. Then Balaam beat on him, and Balaam was so mad he didn't know what to do. And if you've ever dealt with a donkey, you realize how stubborn they can be. When they stop, they stop. And you can pull, push, just about do anything short of lighting a fire under them, and they just stay there. Finally, God just enabled this donkey to turn around and talk to Balaam. And the donkey said, you know, hadn't I been a good donkey? And Balaam said, well, you've been pretty good up until now. And then God opened Balaam's eyes, and here was an angel standing there blocking the way. Now, the donkey obviously had more sense than Balaam did, because when the donkey saw the angel, the donkey had enough sense to stop. Balaam was looking for a way to get around the angel. In fact, the angel told Balaam, said, it's a good thing for you the donkey stopped. I got a sword here. If you'd come any closer, I'd have lopped your head off. But, you know, Balaam kept looking for a way. So God said, all right, you know, you can go. Balaam got down there. He wasn't allowed to pronounce a curse. Finally, Balaam came up with an idea. It's most succinctly stated in Revelation 2. He taught Balak to cast a stumbling block. Balaam recognized that the only way he could bring Israel under a curse was, he said, you know, there is a way we could get God to curse them. Have a party. Have the girls invite them on down. You know, Israel became involved in idolatry and in fornication. They just had a real orgy down there. And the idea was, of course, that this would entice them into sin. And the doctrine of Balaam, there are those who are willing to do anything for a price. You see, they had run greedily after the error of Balaam. There are others. The doctrine of Balaam has to do with enticement into enticing the people of God into things that are in violation of God's way, into compromise with the world. Idolatry, immorality, with fornication either in the literal physical sense or in the spiritual sense. A blending in, a loss of their identity as a separate and holy people of God. This, you know, becoming part of the world. And that's a serious matter. And God devotes several chapters here to the matter of Balaam. And here over a period of several chapters. And finally you read the story that God sent a plague. And one of Aaron's grandsons, Phinehas, was a zealous individual. In fact, things were so blatant in chapter 25, verse 6, that one of the children of Israel came and brought unto his brethren a Midianitish woman in the sight of Moses, in the sight of the congregation. You know, this guy was just so absolutely blatant with it, nobody was going to tell him what to do. Phinehas, Aaron's grandson, was so stirred up, he went and grabbed a javelin and went running into the tent and just skewered him right to the ground. And the plague was stayed. And God said from then on that the priesthood would come down, the high priesthood would descend through the family of Phinehas. He was zealous for the Lord. And he evidenced that zeal. And, you know, it's a matter that God saw a certain attitude, a certain zeal that he had that was good. The rest of the story is told here in terms of in terms of the matter of Balaam. We have the question of inheritance brought up in chapter 27. The daughters of Zelophehad, and certain adjustments made. Then we find offerings spelled out here for the festivals, the Sabbath and the festivals, here in Numbers chapter 28, 29. Chapter 30 about vows. Vows are not to be lightly made by anyone. We find that there were vows were to be taken, it was possible for a vow to be annulled. A woman who was single, still living at home in her father's household, her father could annul her vow. And if she were married, her husband could do so. The vows are not to be lightly made, and it was I think that is something that we see here, the emphasis that is placed on the sanctity. You make a promise, and God expects us to follow through. We have more details here in terms of the Balaam is slaughtered here with the Midianites. We have the story here in chapter 31, and Reuben and Gad and the half tribe of Manasseh receive their inheritance on the east side of the Jordan. Chapter 32, that is that's brought out, and one thing we might note here in chapter 33 that helps answer the question of the distinction between the Passover and the night to be observed, we're told in Numbers 33 verse 3, the children of Israel departed from Ramesses on the first month, on the 15th day of the first month, on the morrow after the Passover. The children of Israel went out with a high hand in the sight of all the Egyptians. Now, that is lined out. Other scriptures show how that back in Deuteronomy 16:1 brings out that God brought them forth out of Egypt by night. Well, if He brought them out by night, He brought them out on the 15th, and He brought them out on the morrow after the Passover, then the Passover had to be on the night of the 14th, because if the night of the 15th when they came out, and it was a day after the Passover, then the night of the 14th was the Passover. So these things, line themselves up here. As we come on down, chapter 35, we find the setup. The Levites were given 48 cities. I think it's sort of interesting. The Levites, the Levites were the ones that administered the judicial system. 35:7, the Levites were given 48 cities with their suburbs. I think it's sort of interesting. The United States, the continental United States, there were 48 states, 48 administrative areas, if you will, in the continental inheritance, the sea to sea that God gave our people. Sort of just a little interesting parallel. Ancient Israel was divided up into 48 areas, or administrative areas, if you want to look at it that way. Each city of the each one of these Levitical cities being the spot where the Levites were set up to judge those areas. The cities of refuge were set apart here in chapter 35, certain Levitical cities. And we find, as we look here and compare the beginning of Numbers and the beginning of Deuteronomy, there was a period of just short of 39 years it's covered. We're right down. Deuteronomy 1 brings us to the 40th year in the 11th month. This is Deuteronomy 1:3. And we found that so they're right down to the end of the 40th year, just short of the 40th anniversary. And Numbers began just a little over a year after, about a year and a month after the Exodus, or a year, actually about a year and 2 weeks after the Exodus that is recorded back there. So you've got just approximately 39 years, almost 39 years. The whole story of Israel in the wilderness is given in the book of Numbers. We've had a chance just sort of to do a survey, but hopefully if you've not had opportunity to go back and study the book of Numbers yourself, this will prompt you to be able to go back through there and to get from it some of the lessons that God would have us have today. So with that, we will be concluded on the book of Numbers, and I'll pass out study questions for next time, which will be the book of Deuteronomy.